Okay, so today is June 11th, 2016. Okay, so we'll start with the homage to the Buddha. I think this might be a little too high. We'll put it down here. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 2, 1. Yeah, okay, this seems all right. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, since the last time we finished the final sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, that's sutta number 152, and if you remember, I didn't take sutta number 1 because even though it comes first in the Majjhima Nikaya, but it's extremely difficult sutta. And so unless one has read the other suttas, particularly the suttas in the group that comes at the end on the six sense bases and the suttas on anatta or non-self, then one wouldn't be able to make head or tails out of the first sutta. But now you'll see that, even though it's somewhat enigmatic, but you'll see with a little explanation it becomes clearer. And this sutta is called in Pali, the Pali name is the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. The word mula, one of its meanings is root, like the root of a tree, the roots of plants. So those are called mula. And then by extension, the word mula, it's also used in the suttas to refer to the roots of action. So the Buddha speaks about greed, hatred, delusion as being the unwholesome roots. Non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion as being the kusala mula, the wholesome roots. And so mula, because it's from the root that the tree or the plant develops, so mula takes on an extended meaning as being the cause. And so mula can be explained as the root cause of things. And then there's another meaning of mula, which is the first, the beginning, because things begin from their cause. And so the word mula comes to be then extended to the origin or beginning of things. And so I think when the compilers of the Pali Canon put the Mula Pariyaya Sutta at the beginning of the Majjhima Nikaya, they did so, maybe one of the underlying ideas was that this is the beginning of the middle-length discourses. So it's the Mula, the root of all of the other discourses. And I think they also put this sutta first because it's, as I say, it's an extremely profound and extremely important sutta. And way back many years ago, when I was just a beginning student of Pali, one of the first projects that I undertook was to translate that sutta together with its commentary and passages from the sub-commentary. And so I put them together into a little book that was published in Sri Lanka. And if one wants to examine the sutta in detail together with its commentarial explanation, you can obtain a copy. I'm not selling them here. But you can obtain a copy. It's published by the Buddhist Publication Society in Sri Lanka. But their North American agent is called Pariyati. So if you search for Pariyati, Pariyati is a Pali word that means the learning of the scriptures. And so this Buddhist publishing company or Buddhist book distribution company took that word as their name. So they call it pariyati.com, or it could be .org, I'm not sure.
What's the name of the book?
The book is called The Discourse on the Root of Existence, available in North America from Pariyati. Just a moment. Hello? Yes, Pariyati, I just gave a plug for you. any profits can be channeled to my personal bank account. Okay, so the word mula, as I was explaining, means root. Then the word pariyati is used in the ancient suttas to indicate a discourse by the Buddha. I don't know how the word has come to acquire that meaning. Literally, it comes from pari is a prefix, which means around. Pariyati. And ya means to go. So literally, it's going around. Almost like a revolution or revolving. Maybe the idea is that a discourse goes around the topic or turns the topic around in order to explain it. But anyway, that is how we find the word pariyati applied to quite a number of the discourses of the Buddha. Like the famous so-called fire sermon is in Pali, Adita Pariyaya. Literally, it's the Pariyaya, the exposition on Adita is blazing. Okay, so let us look at the sutta. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha was living at a place called Ukkata, seldom mentioned in the text, in a grove at the root of a royal sal tree. Then he addresses the monks, calls their attention, and he says, "I shall teach you a discourse on the root of all things, of all dhammas." Yes, so what the expression that the Buddha uses here is, we just have to put the word sabbadhamma. Sabba Dhamma Mula Pariyaya. So the Buddha himself gives the title to this discourse. And the word Dhamma here refers to, it's not Dhamma in the sense of teaching, but it's Dhamma in the sense of phenomena, concrete things. And so even the title sort of underscores the importance of the sutta, since in this discourse the Buddha is getting to the root of things, going down to the root. And what is going to unfold in the sutta, as we'll see, I call this an analysis of the cognitive process, that is the way of mental functioning, of four types of people. There's the first type of person, which is called the worldling, or the common person. Then the way of thinking, the cognitive process of the noble disciple who was on the path. The cognitive process of the arahat, the disciple arahat. And then fourth is the cognitive process of the Buddha, the Tathagata. Okay, so the Buddha begins, like the most developed section, but the most elaborated is the one on the ordinary person. And so here we have, the Buddha says, "Hear, O monks, an untaught ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who has no regard for..." Yeah, this is done in the 1950s by Benvenuto Moli. So he uses true men. But now I would use the gender neutral term. And I would not use true, but rather good persons. "No regard for the good persons and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, perceives earth as earth." So even in the statement, there's quite a bit to be unpacked. And the key term here is the word translated ordinary person, which in Pali is puttujana. In the word putu, this is a compound of the word putu and the word jana. The word jana means a person. And the word putu in Pali can represent either of two Vedic Sanskrit words. One is prithu, which means many. And the other is pritak, which means separate or distinct. You see, in Pali, we don't have this sound, this r, which they have in Vedic Sanskrit. So r is here turns into the u, and we don't have endings like this. And so here, the uk also could turn into a u. And so putu could mean either many or distinct. So puttujana is literally either the many person, or that's the common person, or pritak jana, the one who is separate. In singular, they use pritak, pritak jana, singulis. Pritak jana. Pratakchana. Yeah, so it seems the Sinhalese has taken this as the original. Yeah. So, literally, puttujana, it's the many person or the distinct person. the many person in the sense of the multitude. And the commentaries say the distinct person, because this is a person who is distinct from the noble ones. In my own translation, I've been rendering the word putujana as the worldling, because it means or suggests the person who is engaged, involved in the enjoyments of the world without any insight or understanding. And so we see the way this person is described. First, as he's described as untaught, uninstructed. That is, this type of person hasn't learned the teaching. And so he has no regard for the noble ones, the Aryans. Then he's unskilled, a kovido, in their teaching, which means he doesn't have any kind of understanding or insight into the teaching, and undisciplined or untrained in their teaching. That is, he doesn't have any experience of undertaking the practice of the teaching of the noble ones. Okay, then, after description of the worldling, it says that he perceives earth as earth. You don't mind if I write the Pali? Because there are a number of Pali students here, and sometimes it's interesting to look at the actual expressions in the original. Okay, so the word pattavi means earth. And then if you just look down at the following three sections, you will see water, fire, and air. So you can see that this is the first part of this section is being elaborated in terms of what are called the four great elements. And so we begin with the earth, which is the element that serves as the foundation for the others. And we have, he perceives earth. Here the direct object is pattavim. That's the Pali terminology, grammar, we call it the accusative case. And he perceives it pattavito. The to ending, it's an ablative ending, which has the sense here of perceiving something as something. Like if one sees form, material form is impermanent, anicchaṁ rūpaṁ anicchato pasati. So anicchato, as impermanent. And now I conjecture, if you look at the table that I gave out, everybody got a copy, I assume, that I suppose that there is a primary cognition which isn't actually mentioned in the sutta, and this is simply perceiving, in this case, perceiving earth, perceiving any object. But then, in this case, the case of the worldling is followed, he perceives earth as earth. So this seems, sort of, to us it seems normal and natural. Of course, if I hold up a book, you perceive it as a book. If I drink tea, I perceive it as tea. But what the commentary says is that what occurs here is that a subtle distortion is entering into the perception of earth. That in the case of the worldling, like there are these deep defilements of the deep ignorance which sort of infiltrates into the process of cognition, so that the worldling doesn't go on to understand the object as it really is, but even at the base level of perception, a subtle distortion occurs in the act of perception, whereby the worldling grasps upon, I call this grasping upon, the concrete appearance of the object and takes it as being something which is solid and substantial, not yet thinking about it in that way, but that disposition towards the idea of substance or solidity or substantial existence already sort of infiltrates and pervades and controls the act of perception. So already some kind of tendency or inclination towards a distortion, towards misconception, has already started, sprouted within the act of perception. So the commentary explains this in terms of the text. Other texts speak about four distortions of perception. And these are perceiving the what is impermanent to be permanent, perceiving what is dukkha, unsatisfactory, to be pleasurable, a source of happiness, perceiving what is non-self to be self, and perceiving what is impure to be pure or beautiful. Okay, so in the first stage, the worldling has this distorted perception, grasping upon the concrete appearance of the object, grasping upon that appearance of the object as being something concrete and substantial. Okay, then from perception, we come into the next statement. And I don't like these additions in brackets. I didn't want to include them, this is my confession. But my teacher at the time, Venerable Jnanapanika, the German monk, said, oh, you should include those phrases in brackets so people can understand more clearly. But I think the explanation should belong in the notes, that one should translate the text exactly according to the wording of the text. And so if we just take the wording of the text, we'll leave out those words in brackets. Having perceived earth as earth, he conceives earth to be mine. Okay, so now, with this word that's translated conceives, we're moving beyond bare perception. So the word here, translated as conceives, is manyati, which is from the root man, which means something like to think. But manyati, according to the commentary, well, according to many other texts as well, is not simply what we call clear, objective, evaluative thinking. but rather it is distorted thinking, thinking that is influenced by the mental defilements in such a way that it misconstrues the object. If I could read from my own introduction to the discourse on the root, I said that, okay, the word conceiving manyana comes from the root man, to think. But what is indicated by this word is not simple discursive thinking. The word manyana signifies a different, more developed type of thinking, one that is unwholesome, and always involves a wrong grasp of the object. Manyana is distorted thinking, thinking that comes under the domination of defiled predispositions and imputes to its object properties or relational implications grounded not in the thing itself, but in the constructive activity of the subjective imagination. Manyana is the tendency of thought to misconstrue its object, building upon the distorted perception to apprehend the object in a mode contrary to its actual nature. Okay, so that is the fundamental meaning of the word manyana, or in this case the verb manyati. And the commentaries explain that what is involved in manyati, conceiving, is thought that is influenced by three associated mental defilements. These are craving, conceit, and wrong view. And so in this case we have the worldling conceives the earth, thinks of it under the influence, or in ways that even to a subtle degree are influenced by craving, conceit, and wrong view. And we note that he can conceive in relation to the earth. The text mentions three different ways, which are governed by different cases in the Pali grammar. The first is the direct conceiving, that is, conceiving what's expressed as he conceives the earth. The second involves the locative case, the case of location. He conceives in the earth, in relation to the earth, or as existing in the earth. And then the third case is the ablative case, which indicates apart from or separate from. So he conceives apart from the earth, as separate from the earth. And I think, though I said what is in brackets, I would not put in the text itself, but I think those words in brackets are actually correct. That what's going on is that he is conceiving himself as in some way identical with the earth, taking the earth, could be the earth element of the body, to be myself. Or conceiving in earth, that's taking himself to exist in some way within the earth. Not that he's buried in the ground, but taking the self to exist within this body made up of the four elements, and then conceiving apart from the earth as taking himself, the real self, to be some kind of self-entity existing separate from and apart from all the material elements. And maybe some of you who have been attending classes over the years will recognize here some correspondence with another scheme that we've explained many times, or several times. What scheme is that? Which uses grammatical forms similar to this. Also explained in terms of the uninstructed worldling. Who said that? Good, very good. But there's a specific passage. What is that passage on? A particular term for that? Maybe my question is not phrased clearly enough. Anybody want to take a guess? Bowie? You've come across that passage. You have to speak what? Okay, right, correct. It's the 20 kinds of Sakkaya Ditti, of identity view, where we have also the uninstructed whirling considers form as the self, considers the self as possessing form, considers the self as in form, considers form as in the self. And so we could set up a correspondence here. So we have, he conceives earth. This would be like perceiving form as the self. So taking earth as the self. He conceives in earth. That is like taking the He conceives in earth. That is like taking the self to exist in form. He conceives apart from earth. That is like, or we might say that corresponds to taking form to exist within the self. It's not quite identical, a little different, but maybe similar. Okay, then we have the fourth one. He conceives earth to be mine. This is like taking the self to possess form. Okay, so we have four ways of distorted thinking in relation to the earth element. Ways of thinking governed by craving, by conceit, by views, and which take, in the case of the view, one takes oneself either to be identical with earth, to exist within the earth, to exist apart from the earth, or one takes the self to possess the earth, to exercise ownership over earth. We could see on the expanded scale how this works out when we have things like nationalism and imperialism. This is my country. Our country is the greatest. We are the exceptional nation, the special shining exemplar for the rest of the world. The imperial project, even soft imperialism, that's our sphere of influence. Russians, get off, not yours. Those are our territories. No exploiting, no searching for natural resources in that land. That strip of land belongs to us. Okay, so he conceives earth to be mine. And then the last one, He delights in earth, patavim abhinandati. Okay, so this is abhinandati. It's a verb based on the root nun. From which we get the noun nandi. Sometimes nandati is used in a positive sense, like delighting in the Dhamma. Taking delight in the Dhamma. But often it's used almost as a synonym or as indicative of craving. That is delight, taking worldly delight in the object. We find this word nandi used when the Buddha is explaining the second noble truth. He says that the second noble truth is tanha, which is nandi raga sahagata. So it's craving, which is associated with nandi, with delight, and with raga, with lust or passion. And so here, after misconceiving, misconstruing the earth, taking it to be mine, then the worldling enjoys or takes delight, a worldly delight, delight motivated by craving or by conceit in the earth element. Okay, so then the Buddha takes now going, he's gone from perception to conceiving to delight. Then he raises the question, why is that? Why does all of this take place? And then he gives the answer himself, because he has not fully understood it, I say. Okay, so the key word here is, I guess I can erase this. Aparinyata, which is is the negation. And so we have the word parinyata, which comes from the prefix pari, which gives a sense of fullness, and nyata, which means known. So this is not fully known, not fully understood. And then the commentary gives interesting explanation of this idea of full understanding. It raises the question, what is meant by fully understanding something? And it explains in terms of three kinds of full understanding. Like this is, in a sense, you could say the task in the development of insight or vipassana. You know, people say vipassana means just being present with what exists, just simply being mindful of the present. But actually the mindfulness of the present is intended to bring insight into the nature of phenomena. And the insight involves three stages, three deepening stages. The first stage, I won't write the Pali technical words, but it's jnata parinya, full understanding of the known. This is one investigates with the focused, mindful, concentrated mind. One investigates the nature of phenomena to determine exactly what those phenomena are. That is form. That is feeling. That is perception. Those are the volitional activities. That is consciousness. And so it's defining the five aggregates, or nama-rupa, mentality, materiality, in terms of their distinct characteristics, and then observing their conditions. What are the conditions for the arising of form, the arising of feeling, the arising of perception, the arising of the volitional activities, the arising of consciousness? So observing or discerning the characteristics of mental and physical phenomena along with their conditions. All of that comes under the full understanding of the known. Okay, then the next is called, I translated it in Pali, Tirana Parinya, which I translate full understanding through examination, or full understanding through scrutinization, scrutinizing the phenomena in terms of the three characteristics. That is, after seeing the distinct characteristics, the special or distinctive characteristics of the five aggregates, now one perceives them in terms of the three universal or general characteristics, that all these conditioned phenomena are impermanent, arising and passing away. All of these phenomena are unsatisfactory or defective, they're dukkha, and all of these phenomena are anatta, non-self. And then the third, that's the second level of full understanding. Then the third level of full understanding is called pahana parinya, which is full understanding through abandoning. So it means as one's insight becomes deeper and sharper, then one starts to abandon all kinds of distorted perceptions and views about the nature of phenomena. And as one abandons the distorted perceptions and views, one is abandoning the craving and attachment to the conditioned phenomena. Okay, so if in this case, the Buddha says, because he has not fully understood it, because the worldling has not fully understood the earth element in terms of these three types of full understanding. He has not seen the earth element clearly, simply as that material phenomena with the characteristic of hardness or solidity. He has not perceived, discerned the earth element as impermanent, unsatisfactory, non-self, and has not discarded or abandoned the wrong views about the earth element. Okay, maybe at this point I should ask whether there are any questions. This is a very dense passage, as you can see. Please take the mobile microphone.
To refresh my memory, X equals any of the 24 bases. Now, the 24 bases consist of what? 6 times 4?
Yep. The 24 bases, we're going to come to them.
Oh, okay.
Those are all of the other things in terms of which this process is applied. The earth element is just the first of the 24.
Yeah. Thank you. Because at the top of the list, I have I like to go the top first. So that's why
I see. Does somebody else have a question?
Oh yeah.
Wait, take the wireless microphone.
In front of him is there's often a dandy bull. There's a
statue of a bull sitting or kneeling in front of the temple. And it's usually, quite elaborately done, and it's called the Nandi bowl.
Yeah.
Now, is that the same? Is the same term? Does it mean lustful or?
It's the same word. I don't think it's intended in the sense of lustful, but more in the sense of delightful.
Huh. Okay.
Maybe because the Indians, they love the cows because the cows provide. Of course, the bull doesn't provide milk, but the bull provides cows. The cows provide milk and butter and yogurt and ghee.
Yeah, well, it's also that the killing of a cow is considered more important than the killing of a person who hasn't been twice born.
Yeah.
So it gets inserted into the human hierarchy.
Yeah. One thing that I just thought of when you mentioned Hinduism, and that is that this particular pattern that's developed in this passage, conceiving earth, conceiving in earth, conceiving from earth, this echoes in some way a kind of passage that one finds in some of the Upanishads, the sacred texts of Hinduism, or Brahmanism, in which it's said that the self is that which abides as the all, the self is that which abides in the all, the self abides apart from the all. And so it seems that the Buddha is picking up that kind of pattern, grammatical pattern, and then using it in the opposite way from which the Upanishads are using it. The Upanishads take this to be a way of describing the absolute self, whereas the Buddha uses that pattern to undermine all conceptions or beliefs in a self. Somebody else have a question? Okay, then we'll move on. Now we're moving into the other terms in what I call the 24 bases. So as I said, the earth element is the first. And now that same pattern is applied to the other objects. So we don't have to take each one in detail, but just go through them. So we have water, fire, and air. So you see when you take that in connection with earth. So here we have the four material elements. So that will represent the side of matter. Okay, then the next we have the Pali word is bhuta, which means beings, living beings. But since many of the items to follow are also types of living beings, these would be the gods and other divine beings. So I think beings here has to be taken to represent beings in the lower realms of existence rather than the celestial realms. So you could, perhaps human beings, the earth-dwelling deities, and the beings in the lower realms of existence. The commentary the commentary says, here the word being signifies only living beings below the heaven of the four great kings. The heaven of the four great kings is the lowest of the six sense desire realm heavens. And so below the heaven of the four great kings, we have all other types of living beings. The earth-dwelling deities, sky-dwelling deities, human beings, animals, and then the beings in the hell realms, and the spirits, the pretas, or afflicted spirits. Okay, then we have the next is he perceives the gods as gods. These are the devas. So this we could probably take as the deities dwelling in the six desire realm heavens. Yeah, the commentary says that the gods in the six desire sphere heavenly worlds are intended here as devas. Okay, next comes he perceives Prajapati as Prajapati. And this is a little puzzling. Now the commentary, this is where I disagree with the commentary. The commentary, you see, the word Prajapati means literally, Paja means creation or the population, and Pati means lord or master. So Prajapati is the lord or master of creation. And Prajapati is one of the chief deities in the Vedas. And in fact, there's a story about Prajapati as being like the creator god, that Prajapati underwent this great sacrifice. He sacrificed himself, and from the self-sacrifice, the whole creation emerged. And so it seems to me that the Buddha mentions Prajapati just to bring in this important Vedic deity. But you see, the commentary has to relate this to the Buddha's cosmology. And so the commentary says, Prajapati, the lord of the creation, is Mara. But I take that with a grain of salt. In fact, I won't even take the grain of salt. I think it's just the attempt of the commentator to fit everything into a neat scheme of categories.
Yeah, the early Christian tradition has the same thing with the Gnostics. The Gnostics believed that the creator of the earth was in fact a demiurge, a demon, and that the god that they worshipped was not involved in the creation.
Yeah.
So did not create a world that had such evil in it and was not tainted by it.
Yeah.
And 381 AD, that idea was declared heretical.
Yeah. Okay, so then we have he perceives Brahma as Brahma. Okay, so Brahma was again another deity, or the divine creator of Brahmanism. And the Buddha just, mentions him here because this was a common belief in that period. Okay, now we come to some of the deities in the Buddha, specifically Buddha's cosmology. We have the gods of streaming radiance. These are called the Abhasara deities. Let's do it this way. Yeah, according to the Buddha's cosmology, this is the fine material realm or the form realm. Which is divided into four main layers. First, second, third, and fourth, which are said to correspond to the four jhanas. And then each of these primary realms, or primary layers of the form realm, is divided into three secondary layers. Okay, now the Abhasara deities so the lowest layer of the form realm is called the Brahma world, and that is the world which is presided over by Mahabrahma. So when the Buddha mentions he perceives Brahma as Brahma, that is referring to the Brahma world. Okay, then we come to the second plane of the form realm, the higher plane. And of the three divisions there, the highest is the deities or the devas of streaming radiance. And so when the Buddha mentions the gods of streaming radiance, then he's referring to the second level of the form realm. Then next come the gods of refulgent glory. These are the Subakina deities. So those are the devas that dwell at the third level of the form realm. And then we come to the next, in section 13, the gods of great fruit. So those are, in Pali, those are the Vaihappala devas. So those are the deities or divine beings dwelling at the fourth level, the fourth layer of the form realm. So this cosmology is a little bit like a concert hall in which there is the I don't know the technical terms, the sort of the ground level?
The tiers.
Yeah, they're like the tiers, but is there a technical term for the ground level tier?
The orchestra. The orchestra level.
That's called the orchestra level. Okay, and then we have like the second layer, it's Is that called the mezzanine? Yeah, that's good. I think the mezzanine. And maybe for the special powerful devas, they have their boxes. You know, if you see the movies about the 19th, 18th century, 19th century concert halls, the aristocrats go to the... They have their boxes. I still remember, I think it was the Bela Lugosi version of Dracula, where Dracula turns up in the box at the concert hall. Okay, then there's the third level, that's the balcony, and then the fourth level. Yeah, I was thinking of the word bleachers.
It's usually the nosebleed seats, the ones that are highest up of the nosebleed seats.
Nosebleed?
Yeah, they're not the most auspicious.
Yeah, except that there's a inversion here in that. I think in the concert hall, the lower level is considered the best. And as you go, well, maybe the mezzanine is also classy. But as you go above that, those are the cheap seats. Whereas in the Buddhist cosmology, the ticket prices increase as one goes up the scale of the devas. So in order to get reborn in the Brahma world, one has to master the first jhana. But if one aspires for the Abhasara world, you have to master the second jhana. To get to the Subhakina, you have to master the third jhana. And to get reborn in the Vaihapala world, one has to master the fourth jhana. And what's interesting here is that the text recognizes that the worldling, you know, we think of a worldling as somebody who might be just going to boxing matches and watching porn on the internet and going to the bar, you know, for entertainment on Saturday evening. But a person who masters even these exalted high meditative attainments but lacks the wisdom of the Dhamma is still considered a worldling. So the yogis and the ascetics in the Buddha's time and even up to the present who master these deep meditative absorptions, these deep samadhis, they gain access to these realms. They can perceive them with divine eye. They can, with mystical power, they can travel to those realms. But they still have the subtle manyana, distorted ways of thinking. And so they'll misconceive them and misinterpret them. Okay, so this takes us to the gods of great fruit. Then next comes something called, in Pali, is called Abhibhu, which is translated here as overlord. It's a little bit puzzling to me why that was included. The commentary gives a rather unconvincing explanation. It seems to me my hypothesis would be that the Buddha is just bringing in terms from that were used in Brahmanism. And so Abhibhu could have been a term that the Brahmins used to designate one of their deities or a group of deities. So I wouldn't lose sleep over trying to interpret this. Okay, next comes, well, the next four we take together. So these are the four levels of the formless meditative attainments. The base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, and the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And so a worldling, a person who's technically still a worldling, can master samadhi to the point of achieving these four formless meditations. And if you remember the story of the Buddha, of his quest for enlightenment, before when he was still a seeker of enlightenment, under his first teacher, he learned the base of nothingness. So his teacher must have been one who attained the base of nothingness, but the Buddha taught that, where he realized after some time that this practice by itself doesn't lead to enlightenment and liberation. And then under his second meditation teacher, he learned the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And again, he left his teacher. So in the Buddha's time, you know, there were the yogis, meditation masters, who achieved these very, very profound states of meditative absorption. But for the Buddha, they're not the final solution. Okay, next we come to, I'll go through all of them and then I'll ask for questions. Okay, next comes a group of four terms that come together. It's a way of classifying all the objects of experience. So here we have, we take them together, the seen, the heard, the sensed, and the cognized. So the seen is visible form. Everything that comes within the range of eye consciousness. The heard is everything that comes within the range of ear consciousness. The third term, in Pali, it's mutta, and here it's translated the sensed. And so this can be understood as everything that comes within the range of the other three senses, smell, taste, and touch. So all of those objects, odors, flavors, and textures. And then the fourth is the cognized. So this is everything that is known apart from immediate sense experience. Everything which is thought, conceived, imagined, pondered, reflected upon, all ideas, judgments, decisions, volitions, everything else of a non-sensory nature that is known. Okay, next we come to two terms that are sort of contrasted with one another. This is unity or oneness, ekata, and the other is diversity or difference. In Pali, it's ekata versus nanata. And the commentary explains that unity, this refers to the experience in the states of meditative absorption, samadhi, where the mind becomes unified on the object, and just a single, simple object becomes present to consciousness. And diversity refers to the totality of non-meditative experience, where there are constantly changing objects, continually objects that are diverse, always different. Okay, then in section 25, we come to perceiving all as all. So this is taking everything, all the whole universe of conditioned phenomena, taking everything together under one category, the all. And probably the Buddha mentions this because, again, this would have been like an important theme in the Upanishads, in that way of thinking. It's the basis, could be the basis for what are called the monistic philosophies. The idea that everything is one, of one essence, and the idea that all of that totality of things is identical with myself, or myself exists in this totality of things, or myself is something separate from the totality of things. If you want to get detailed explanations, again, a plug. Order it now, copies, just few copies left. There's been a sudden rush. Don't forget there are people on the internet who are following this class. They might have placed their orders already. So you find detailed explanation in this book. Okay, so now we've gone through 23 bases of conceiving, and now we come to the 24th, the last one. He perceives Nibbana as Nibbana. And this is where the commentators get a little bit nervous, like their sacred cow is being brought under this range of conceiving. And so the commentaries say, I think I have the note here. Yeah, the commentary says that Nibbana refers to the five kinds of supreme Nibbana here and now. And this concept of Nibbana here and now, this is explained in the first discourse of the Digha Nikaya. So, the first kind of Nibbana here and now is the thesis that when one fully enjoys the five types of sense objects, beautiful forms, sounds, odors, tastes, textures, that is Nibbana here and now. You know, apparently there were some philosophers in the Buddha's time who had that position, that the way to Nibbana is taken as, you know, the ultimate bliss, the ultimate freedom. So the ultimate bliss, freedom, and happiness is to fully immerse oneself in the enjoyment of the senses. Then there were other philosophers, the meditators, who held that the first jhana is the ultimate Nibbana. Others said the second jhana. Still others, the third jhana. Still others, the fourth jhana. And so we have sensory enjoyment and the four jhanas. Those are the five kinds of Nibbana here and now, supreme Nibbana here and now. That's the way the commentary explains Nibbana here. But I think I'm suspicious that the commentary is a little bit nervous about the Buddha's mentioning Nibbana here. I think it's probably misconceptions that a person who doesn't have deep insight into the Dhamma will form about the Buddha's idea of Nibbana. So, in an uninstructed worldling, in fact, there were books or ideas, articles and essays published when Buddhism first became known in the West. Like some took Nibbana to be the true self, that the Buddha rejected the false, illusory self, but for him, Nibbana was the true self. And others will think, when I achieve Nibbana, then I will exist within Nibbana. Or else they think Nibbana is one thing, I'm something else, I have to achieve Nibbana. Then I can pride myself, and now I can go on Facebook and put in my Facebook wall, I've attained Nibbana. Please, my Facebook friends, click like. Thumbs up. I've gotten there. Okay, so having perceived Nibbana as Nibbana, he conceives Nibbana perhaps taking himself to be, his true self to be identical with Nibbana. He conceives in Nibbana, taking himself to exist in Nibbana. He conceives from Nibbana, again taking himself to be apart from Nibbana, with the idea of, I'm here, Nibbana's there, I have to go there, get it. And then when he experiences, maybe has some mind-shattering experience of meditation, he thinks, ah, I've gotten it, Nibbana is mine. And then he delights in his idea of Nibbana. And why is that? Because he has not fully understood it. Okay, I hope I helped to make this rather cryptic, enigmatic passage a little bit clearer. We have some time for questions, if you have questions now. Okay, Michael in the back. It's good if we pass the wireless mic back to him.
Abhante, earlier today we spoke of delight associated with craving and greed.
Yeah.
And here we have delight not associated with craving and greed. So are they to be juxtaposed, or are we to understand them as two opposing delights?
No, the delight that's spoken about in this sutta,
yes,
is the delight that's associated with craving.
Oh, that's the earlier one. But here we just talked about the idea of nirvana, and we said that you said that the commentators probably erroneously associated four or five levels or types of nirvana here and now. And the first one I think you mentioned was delight.
I said the first, this is the view of
the commentators.
So this is the way, that's the way the commentators interpret the expression nirvana here. It's not their position. But they say that Nibbana here refers to the five theories of supreme Nibbana here and now. And those five theories, the first was the idea that supreme Nibbana is free indulgence in sensual enjoyments. And then the next four are the attainment of the four jhanas.
I see, those would be the Gnostic Buddhas of the times.
The what?
The Gnostic Buddhas. Anyway, it's a little ill-conceived joke. Mm.
Yes, how is it determined that you've reached this master of the higher levels of attainment? Is it from your teacher? I mean, because this isn't your own, it can't be your own perception.
Yeah, of course this question is not so directly relevant to the sutta, but one might have like special experiences in meditation, which one might identify with one of the jhanas, but then to get confirmation, one would have to present it to a qualified teacher to see whether it's really the case. Is that Dina? Okay. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I need some context. I'm really having trouble figuring out. When you talked about the levels of formless meditation, you said this is not the final solution.
Yeah.
That puzzled me. What are we solving? Where are we headed? I know this is so basic a question.
Yeah, okay.
I'm sorry for it, but I don't know where I'm going here.
Okay, what I meant when I said this is not the final solution, or the Buddha recognized this was not the final solution, because the Buddha was seeking enlightenment and liberation, nibbana. And apparently his teachers thought they had reached these high formless meditations. They thought, must have thought, that this is the supreme attainment. But the Buddha saw that these are still defective states. And so he, went off in a different direction.
In other words, these states are not where we're really headed. We're headed higher than that.
Yeah. These are states of deep These are states of deep concentration. So we have like the eight levels, the four jhanas. Then beyond the fourth jhana, we have the next four levels and the four formless meditations. The base of infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, neither perception nor non-perception. And at each level, the mind is becoming quieter, more peaceful, more concentrated, more refined, till when one gets to the base of neither perception nor non-perception, that is the finest and subtlest state of consciousness possible in the domain of concentration. But for the Buddha, concentration, deep concentration, was not enough. One has to go beyond by understanding things with wisdom, with insight. So the Buddha brought those states of samadhi into his system of practice, but he didn't treat them as the final solution. One has to, if one attains them, then one has to step out and then examine things with insight. Okay, unless there's... Are there any other questions? Anyway, you have lunchtime to ponder this. And so we'll stop now, and we'll do the sharing of the merits. And again, I don't want to be pushy. I don't get any royalties. I'm not going to get on... I would like to be on the Times bestseller list. But if you do want a detailed explanation of the sutta with 25-page introduction, I won't tell you who the author of the introduction is. And then you have the translation of the sutta. And then you have the commentary explanation of the sutta with extracts, a very special deal. Extracts from the Tika, the sub-commentary, the sub-commentary is very, very insightful. The author of the sub-commentary seems to have been a very subtle and profound thinker. Okay, and then if you are experiencing aches and pains in your joints... No, that's the wrong one. Pull it. Okay, so we'll end with the sharing of the merits. So you have the verse, the sheet was distributed? No? Oh, I see. It was put here to be distributed. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was...
I put it in the drawer last class.
I assume everybody got this sheet with the sort of, which shows the layout of the structure, the schematic representation of the sutta. Anybody didn't get this sheet? Anybody who came in late?
Can I take it to Suki and Stephen? Oh,
yeah. And I should mention, I announced last week, or a few days ago, that I wouldn't have the class next week, because I thought I would be going away, but it seems that this won't work out. Should we have the class next week? You want to have it next week? Okay, so we'll have it next week. I'll just have to send out early an announcement that we will have the class. Okay, so let us do the sharing of the merits. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodita chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodita chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodita chiram rakantu mamparam. Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanubodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anubodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanu modantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagupadaya avici hetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha asanya sanino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. And they say sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, then we end three times with the half bow.